Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending on where it is you're listening. This is Dan Turchin, CEO of Insight Finder, Executive Chairman of PeopleRain, and host of AI and the Future of Work. You know, in Silicon Valley, we've cliched the phrase, data is the new oil, just beyond recognition, in part because it's self-serving. We are the ones generating and selling the data, but also because we say biohack our way into a new conception of what it means to be human, we constantly need to reconcile our relationship with our own digital twin. Yeah, it's kind of heady stuff, but it's also a topic that's going to become mainstream in the next 18 months. As you know, the volume of data that we generate is growing exponentially, yet sadly, our ability to manage and understand it just isn't. One of the dirty secrets of data scientists is that even here in 2020, they still spend most of their time wrangling data. Fascinating technologies are being born every day to make sense out of these noisy data streams. We're lucky enough today to have a founder and CEO who is on the forefront of making sure data is available and used effectively. Barr's company, Monte Carlo, helps manage data pipelines. It's a hard problem to solve, and until someone gets it right, that cliche about data and oil will only be accurate because they're both dangerous, expensive to store, and facilitate some pretty atrocious behavior when left in the wrong hands. But that's about enough from me. Let's learn from the expert. Barr Moses, welcome to the podcast. Could you share with us the founding vision behind Monte Carlo?
Hi, Dan. Great to be here. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Happy to. So, yeah, the story of Monte Carlo actually started perhaps a long time ago. So I've been in data for the last decade or so. Most recently, prior to founding Monte Carlo, I was VP at a company called Gainsight, where I was fortunate to work with some of the best sort of customer success and data teams, and also led the team internally that was responsible for customer data and analytics. Which meant that, you know, me and my team were responsible for reports and dashboards that were being used in order to make decisions about the business. And we were plagued with bad data all the time. We sort of spent too much of our time on it. I remember sort of this Monday morning coming into the office and just getting a flood of emails about all the things that, went wrong over the weekend. And then started this process of sort of figuring out what was the root cause and what specific change somewhere upstream broke everything downstream, sort of created this sort of mess. And we'd have to kind of manually look at reports every day to check the numbers and make sure that they're accurate. It seemed, a little crazy to me. And, I think I realized that if we really wanted to get data-driven as an organization, but more broadly as an industry, something here needs to change in our approach. There needs to be some significant paradigm shift in order to truly allow for that future. And so I internally, actually hacked together this sort of bare bones solution and then implemented it to some of our customers, which definitely worked and helped. But then I also wanted to kind of validate this sort of beyond my personal experience. And so I actually spoke to over 100 data leaders and data professionals to understand, are they facing sort of some of the same experiences that I've experienced? And time again, this problem just came up. And, really anyone who's in data, long enough has experienced something like this. Like someone makes a change upstream, which then sort of results in corrupted reports or dashboards downstream. And you only find out about it because a consumer, maybe your customer, maybe your CEO, maybe your marketing team actually, happens to find that issue. Oftentimes, data teams are, in fact, the last to know about these problems. When I was thinking about this sort of at an industry level, I just realized it's not just my personal experience. Everyone has these scars on the back, from sort of small startups to large organizations like Netflix and Uber, et cetera. And just learned that this was a huge problem and that the impact on companies was huge, from millions of dollars lost to regulation and compliance risks, really just sort of significant, all too common reality that was detrimental for companies. And so actually decided, you know, sort of inspired by a desire to make it easier for data teams, you know, so that one, they're the first to know about data problems. Two, that once there is a data problem, you can sort of identify it quickly. Actually decided to start Monte Carlo. And our kind of, vision or mission is, to accelerate the adoption of data, accelerate the world's adoption of data by reducing data downtime. So that's sort of the founding story.
So before the episode and a little bit during your description of the founding vision, we kind of casually use this term data pipeline, but I realize that it may not be as mainstream a term to all of our listeners as it is, you know, maybe to you and I. What is a data pipeline? And perhaps most importantly, why do they break so often?
Good question. And one sort of maybe kind of metaphor or corollary to think about this is to kind of help explain how sort of people work with data and what the process is of working with data is actually to use a simple example of, say, like think about a car factory. You know, what goes into actually creating a car? You know, there's probably, you know, sort of a bunch of different sources, right? Like you take in like glass, metal, rubber, et cetera. And then you take sort of all of these sources and you start kind of, there's probably a number of different steps in a factory, right? Sort of putting all that together, putting the car together, and then at the end, you get a car and then you get to drive it. And imagine that only when you're driving the car at like 60 miles per hour, that's when you find out that like all the windows suddenly break at 60 miles per hour, right? How crazy is that, right? You probably should be testing for the quality of the glass and everything else somewhere along those steps to really make sure that you can then use these sources in an appropriate way down the line when it's being consumed. And so this is, you know, obviously kind of a simplified example, but if you think about a data pipeline, you know, you have a number of different sources, maybe thousands of sources for some companies, very different kinds of data, types of data. You take all of those in, you put it, you store it somewhere in a data lake, maybe in a data warehouse, you transform it, you can load it into different locations. And then at some point, you know, there's sort of an end product, right? Maybe that's a machine learning model, maybe that's sort of a BI report. And then there's a consumer at the end that is using that to make a decision, but there's also people along sort of the different steps of data. And so, the way in which sort of data sort of is being ingested and processed, data can break basically anywhere along that point from the beginning throughout the various stages to the very end. And so, you know, when you think about kind of the main causes of why a data pipeline might break, those can really, really vary. There's probably, you know, millions of different reasons of why a pipeline can break. Just to name a few examples, there's more and more, as I mentioned, like data sources that you're relying on coming in. What if, you know, one day one of those data sources just stops coming in, right? Like for some reason that doesn't depend on you or your system, there's a third party source that stops sending data, right? That is a good reason for sort of the rest of your pipeline to be impacted. Another second reason is that, there's bigger teams and more people that are actually involved in the process of ingesting, processing, and transforming data. And so oftentimes miscommunications between those teams can lead to broken pipelines. So a specific example is if you have, you know, an engineer that made a change to your website, or someone that made a change to some of your applications, and you have sort of number of data pipelines and reports, say on your marketing team that rely on sort of the website and the data that is coming from your website. If you're unaware of that change that happened in your website, that change might actually significantly impact your report. Maybe it was a schema change and the field could no longer be used anymore in your report. Or maybe just the definition of how the data is collected has changed and you were unaware of that. And because there isn't a good way to communicate about these changes and there isn't a good way to track these changes, it's very easy, in fact, to break a data pipeline. And honestly, it's just a reality that we see all data teams deal with. And the more we rely on data, the more we add to the data system, the more complex it gets, and the harder it is to make sure that every step of the way, the data is actually accurate and eventually can be trusted.
Are these examples hit way too close to home? The hair on the back of the neck of everyone in AI and machine learning is standing up right now as they hear your description. So I really enjoyed your you've written a blog post, Quantifying the Impact of Data Downtime. Maybe talk us through what is data downtime and maybe how do you think about quantifying the impact?
Yeah, so data downtime as a concept is sort of the definition is periods of time when data is missing, inaccurate, or otherwise erroneous. And this basically, to your point, sort of affects all data-driven companies, right? Regardless of sort of industry, this is the, I'm waking up at 3 a.m. at night sweating because I'm worried that the data is wrong and I'm going to report on it tomorrow and who knows what's going to happen, right? It's really sort of the nightmare kind of stuff that you know, we're passionate about eradicating or minimizing. But really sort of where this come from, it actually comes from a corollary to application downtime, which is a concept that, you know, is more widespread today. So what is application downtime? If you think about kind of the evolution in the last couple of decades, let's take an example of a specific website. You know, if my website sort of goes down, or, you know, a couple of decades ago, if my website went down for a few minutes, probably nobody noticed because nobody was really looking at my website. And it just wasn't a big deal, right? Just sort of the beginning of having websites. But in today's world, that seems ridiculous, right? Like I think Netflix has this talk about how their website was down for 45 minutes or their app was down for 45 minutes. I think this was sort of earlier in 2015 or 2016, which was sort of a huge momentous time for Netflix, you know, significant revenue impact. And, you know, obviously sort of when your app is down, that's a very, very big deal. And so, you know, in the last decade or so, we've come up with sort of new sort of methods and ways in order to support teams to make sure that your apps are always up and running, right? And that's sort of the concept of DevOps and observability, in which sort of teams work hard to make sure that your apps are always up and running. And I think the same thing is happening for data. So today, you know, your data might be, you know, potentially wrong in a few places, and that's okay. Maybe it's okay in some teams or some organizations, but, you know, in the next sort of year to 3 years or 5 years, like, it's just not going to cut it. Not anymore. We're going to need to be able to find ways to make sure that there's, like, in the same way that we have sort of five nines of availability of our applications, we're going to need to have five nines of availability of our data. And the more that our data sort of powers up our applications, the more this is going to be important. We're not going to be able to sort of, you know, have our data be wrong here and there. And I think part of that means also having the right language to describe this problem. Because if we have the right language, we can sort of treat it with the diligence that it demands. And so really kind of measuring data downtime, having SLAs for data and SLOs for data is a really important sort of step of maturity for the industry, in my opinion. Now, in terms of quantifying data downtime, I think the best way is to think about sort of the impact of this on your organization. So when data is wrong, who's being hit, right? Starting from, you know, significant revenue. So just to give an example, you know, an e-commerce company where their website is literally their product, if the data is wrong in their website and customers are actually looking at data that's wrong, that's as bad as actually having the entire website being down, right? Like, in a way, it's almost better to not have a website than have a website with the wrong information on it. And so that's significant, you know, revenue that's just, you know, being impacted right there. To, you know, specific, you know, compliance risks, right? Like GDPR and such could be like 4% of your revenue. And in that case, like when your data is wrong, you're actually putting your organization at risk. You know, there's sort of lots of companies that deal with sort of credit card data or any sort of kind of sensitive data. And if, you know, if that data is wrong, it's a significant risk that can be quantified. And then, you know, I would say maybe the third example for sort of the cost of data downtime is really how much time is your team spending on data downtime? From our research, you know, anywhere between 30 to 80% of a data team's or data organization's time could be spent on data fire drills. This is just something that, you know, every data team deals with. And in the reality in which you spend the large majority of your time trying to identify data problems and then fix them, that's incredibly costly for any organization. And most teams today deal with this problem in a very reactive way. One in which they learn about data downtime from other people or other organizations, and then start this scramble to figure out what was the root cause, you know, backload the data, et cetera. So it's definitely a very costly problem, data downtime, and one that I'd say is only going to get worse from here as we rely on more and more data to power our businesses.
So data downtime is expensive. It's something you can quantify the impact. The obvious next question is, how do you coach data teams to eliminate it and start trusting their data pipelines?
Yeah, so the good news is we don't have to reinvent the wheel. Software engineering as an industry has solved it in that sense, in the sense that, you know, if you think about sort of going back to the analogy about application downtime, you know, we talked a little bit about the fact that we've, in the last decade or so, domain of observability has emerged as a fast growing area that supports DevOps teams who manage application downtime. And so these teams have specific metrics that they track. Just as an example, they track latency or performance, and those metrics help them understand the health of their applications to make sure that they are up and running as much as possible. I think we can take that concept and apply that to data. And so that's what we call data observability, which is basically an organization's ability to understand the health of their data in their system. And that what that means is that, you know, just in the same way that applications can break for millions of different reasons, there's still a coherent way for us to instrument and monitor and analyze those systems to understand their health. And taking that and applying that to data, data pipelines can break for millions of different reasons, but there's still a coherent framework or set of metrics that we can use and tools that we can that we're building in order to instrument and monitor and analyze your data pipelines so that you are aware about the changes and breaks in your data, and you can ultimately use that to eliminate data downtime and actually proactively prevent data downtime to begin with. In the same way that sort of that's applied to DevOps. And so in the data observability sort of concept, we think about sort of five key pillars that help give you sort of this holistic view and understanding of the health of your data. And those five pillars are, the first is freshness. So it has everything to do with kind of like the timeliness of your data. So all these different metrics around, you know, has the data arrived in the same way that it should be arriving? Second is around sort of volume of the data. So whether that's like row count or byte count, basically making sure that you're getting sort of the volume of data that they'd expect and need. The third is schema changes. We talked a little bit about how, you know, what someone can make a change somewhere to a field, which will then impact a lot of things downstream. Well, schema changes addresses exactly that, whether it's a field that's being added or removed or changed in its type. The fourth pillar is distribution, which speaks really to sort of kind of like the distribution of a particular field and the correlations between fields, how they're changing together or not. And then fifth is lineage. And lineage, I think the important part about lineage is actually lineage that's automated and ML driven in a way that sort of allows your organization to have the map of your assets. And understand kind of how these things depend on each other. So if there was a schema change that happened somewhere upstream, how does that influence a freshness problem with the table downstream that impacts a report that maybe your, you know, CMO is using to make important decisions? So lineage helps us tell this story and helps us put together these different sort of stages of the world, if you will. And these sort of concepts together really bring you sort of the confidence and visibility into the health of your data.
So I want to shift from what it is that Monte Carlo is doing and talk a little bit about the company itself. How would outsiders describe the culture at Monte Carlo?
The team is probably maybe, you know, the most important part for us at Monte Carlo and culture. And that's something that, you know, both me and my co-founder, Lior, have thought about from day one. And I really believe that sort of building a culture is kind of is teamwork as well in the early days. And so, you know, we think a lot about that. Actually, interestingly, nearly everyone sort of plays an instrument. So I've been thinking that we should probably start a band or something. We might do that. You know, more practically, kind of, we are remote first from day one. And so, you know, while we kind of work from all corners of the world, we stay connected through sort of different, you know, meetings and different kind of processes that we have to create culture. And so, you know, once a month we get together and have a fun activity. For example, you know, we actually invited a shark expert to give us a presentation on kind of shark populations off the coast of South Africa. We had a mindfulness teacher sort of walk us through a joy and wellness exercise. We had a magician come and sort of teach us some tricks. I'm a big fan of math magics. And so, you know, we really make a point to sort of have, you know, strong connectedness, even in these times of kind of remote work. That's probably one sort of key element of the culture. And then I would say the second is we're really customer obsessed. You know, my background in customer success and sort of the, you know, everyone on the team is really, really sort of passionate about, or what gets us excited in the morning is seeing our customers shine. And, you know, we think that there's sort of lots of opportunities to help data teams and data organizations. And it's just our sort of great fortune to be able to work with some of the sort of pioneers of the data reliability industry, you know, and I'm just inspired every day by our customers and by how much, you know, how innovative they are and how they think about data downtime in their organizations. And we learn so much from them. You know, it's great partnerships to have and to build this company together. So I see both of those, you know, team obsessed and customer obsessed as very important for our culture.
How would you describe your leadership style?
Oh man, that you'd really have to ask my team. Yeah, you know, I think I was fortunate to work with people in my career, with people who believed in me probably more than I believe in myself, and really pushed me to be the best version of myself. And so I try to pay that forward to the best of my ability, whether that's kind of an extending trust from day one, you know, promoting people before they ask for it, creating a safe place for people to experiment and fail and also express themselves. And so I very much believe in kind of, you know, building the company around the people and not the people around the company. And so hiring, you know, the best people who are sort of really excited about the mission and you know, designing our company around that and really paying it forward. You know, we have a few sort of values that I really believe in the company. So one of them is beat the odds, meaning kind of like set ambitious goals and beat them and pull each other to overachieve together. I really believe that there are some companies that kind of change people's careers. You know, it would be sort of my greatest honor to make Monte Carlo a company that, you know, significantly changes people's careers and lives for the better. That's sort of what, you know, why a lot of the reasons for why I get excited about sort of working with my team. The second value or another value that we have is measure in minutes, which means that, you know, for sort of a startup like us, you know, time and speed is one of sort of our most important assets. And so our ability to move fast is very important. And then the last value or sort of the third that I'll mention is have fun. You know, life is so short and startups are so hard. And so you better have fun while you're doing it. You know, and it's part of the magic of a startup.
Now in Silicon Valley, there's a glass ceiling. Some would say it's a cement ceiling for females and underrepresented entrepreneurs. You've had so much early success. You've raised from some of the greatest in Excel and Redpoint and GGV, et cetera. What's your advice for females or for underrepresented minority entrepreneurs?
So it's definitely been part of my decision to kind of start Monte Carlo is sort of tied to this reality, right? In which, you know, there needs to be way more female founders and even more so in data infrastructure and enterprise software in particular. But, you know, I think we, you know, we've had some great recent examples, whether it's, you know, as an example as RBG, right? Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who I think, you know, is an extremely sort of positive example, set the bar incredibly high for herself, was wildly successful in her arena. And then ultimately, as a result, was able to change the system from within and have an impact that went sort of far beyond that, you know, and with our new vice president as well, who mentioned, you know, she's Kamala Harris. She's the first, but not the last. And so those are the kind of examples that inspire me. And, you know, I think for us founders, we sort of need to create as many positive examples as we can so that, you know, we are maybe the first, but not the last. And so, you know, for founders, I think focusing, or at least the way that I think about this is kind of what can I do to create the best example that I can? And I think that means for me building a massive business that you know, promotes diversity and inclusion, and one that, you know, we can be really proud of as we're building. And so, of course, we have sort of many opportunities to kind of promote this along the way. And we think about this all the time, whether it's hiring diverse people, you know, building a diverse community, having a diverse website, like literally from every detail to the broader mission of the company. I basically wake up every day and think about, like, how can I build the best company possible? How can I set the best example in my arena? And I think, you know, that sort of that's what I believe in, is sort of a path to creating more great examples of sort of wildly successful female leaders.
I hope that Kamala is listening. It was a nice compliment for her. And I know that RBG is listening from the grave.
I hope so.
And giving you a nice thumbs up. So we're just about out of time, but I got to get in at least one last question for you. Bar, your advice to a younger version of yourself.
I think when I was younger, and still to a certain degree today, you know, really, I think sort of struggle with, or used to struggle with, kind of like perfection. So I would say, like, you know, perfect is the enemy of good, right? And I think I've gotten better over time, but it's still something that, you know, especially kind of in order to make change, you just have to have like many at bats, right? And so focusing on that, and focusing on, you know, knowing that it is possible to defy the odds, and you need to have the guts to just step into it, be in the arena every day, be present every day, stick with that, be present with that. You know, I think if I had remembered that back then, it might have been a little bit easier. But, you know, I think especially when you're sort of founding a company, this is important, right? When you start out with an idea, people might think that you're crazy. People might think that people might not even understand what you're working on. But, you know, if you really believe in it and you have conviction in what you're doing, and you sort of can't imagine the world without what you're building, then, you know, you have to keep going. Yeah, just do it. Don't be afraid.
I told you that was the last question, but one more and then we got to wrap up. Your quarantine hobby. You mentioned math magic. Is that your thing, or what's getting you through all the closed door time?
Oh, I'm a huge fan of action movies. I'm actually a big fan of Bruce Willis movies in particular. I've watched every one many times. But watching movie and action movies is probably the thing that I do most. And then in quarantine, it actually works well.
Good stuff. Well, Bar, this has been so much fun. We've talked a lot about the future of data. My one request is, as that future comes to fruition, would you mind coming back and maybe having the second version of this conversation?
Absolutely. It was a pleasure. Great question. And happy to chat.
Well, great work. Really good. Good having you on the show. Thank you, of course, to Bar. We are back next week with another fascinating guest. This is Dan Turchin, your host of AI and the Future of Work.